All right, so we're at session three, from dirt to dominion. Where did we come from? And if you remember the first session, we talked about that every worldview has to answer some basic questions about reality. You have to answer some basic questions about reality. And so what we're going to do over the time that we have remaining this weekend is look at how specifically Christianity answers those questions in relation to and in contrast to how other worldviews answer those questions. And so the first set of questions that a worldview has to answer, right, is why are we here? Why is there something rather than nothing? Where did we come from? How did we get here? Why are there humans? Why are humans different than animals? Why is the world the way it is? And every worldview, if it's going to make sense to our lives, has to begin by answering that question. And really, this question of origins, the question of how did we get here, is very, very important. Because everything else in a worldview is downstream from this question. Where we came from, how we got here, sets the stage for then everything else, which are the other two questions, which is what's wrong with the world? Wow. And thirdly, what can we do to fix it? What's the answer to that problem? And so everything downstream, everything in a worldview is downstream from the question of origins. Now, in some ways, this is kind of a philosophical question, but it's also a deeply personal question, and I hope you guys can see that. This question of how do we get here is really, why are you here? How did you get here? On this place called Earth, what's the point? What's the point of life? Who are you? Fundamentally, who are you, and what were you placed here on this planet to do? And so this question of our where we came from is deeply personal as well. And so we need to consider it not just as a philosophical question, but also as a personal question. So, so in considering worldviews, we need a worldview that not only explains the world around us, but explains ourselves. Right? You need to have a lens for life that, as you look at the world, it makes sense. But also, then, as you turn inward and look at yourself and look at your own existence, it makes sense. And frankly, a lot of the worldviews, in fact, every other worldview out there, doesn't hold up to that. Now, today, teens are dealing with a lot of stress. There's a lot going on in the life of a teenager. If statistics are anything, they show that depression is on a high rise amongst teenagers. Many are being bullied or bullying, and many are drinking as well, along with other illegal substances. And guys, we need to realize that these issues don't show up out of nowhere. These issues of depression and turning to substance abuse and attacking other people and whatnot, these things aren't just suddenly, they don't just pop out of the air and they go, oh wow, I'm depressed today. No, these things are coming about because of the worldview that people have. And it's my contention that because of the reigning worldview of science and materialism, it's placing a view of the self and of the person that is causing people to lose hope and to be depressed and to look for satisfaction elsewhere. And so, like we saw yesterday, Darwinism, evolution, is also a belief. It is a competing belief to Christianity. It was discovered, it was invented as a competing belief to Christianity. And so, as we look at this question of how do we get here, we're going to compare what the Darwinist worldview says to what God says on how we got here, okay? So first, we're going to look at Darwinism. We're going to look at evolution, and I'm not going to give you necessarily a little lesson on evolution, on what they, how they explain they get here. But what I'm going to hopefully show you is that evolution doesn't hold up. Okay? Now, as we said last night, in evolution, matter, physical things, is eternal. That is what has forever existed. In fact, if you've heard people talk about, you try to keep asking them, well, where did that come from? Where did those cells come from? Where did those little particles come from? They can't go back to nothing. They have to have a place in which there was something. In fact, they even go back to aliens. Maybe aliens from someplace else came and delivered them here. And you're like, well, where did the aliens come from? See, they don't have a starting point because matter has to be eternal because matter takes the place of God. And so everything in a worldview has to have something that's divine, that lasts forever, that's eternal, and that must be taken by faith. How do they know matter is eternal? They don't. They're taking it by faith. And so even though they try to explain the beginning of things with theories like the Big Bang, they still believe that there was something before the Big Bang. There never was a time when matter didn't exist. And this is the foundation for their worldview. Now, when you try to ask people what are the observable evidences of evolution, right? Evolution is supposedly built upon hard science, observable things. You know, we believe in only what we can see with our eyes and feel with our hands and observe, and that's how we're going to discern the world, and that's why I believe in evolution. And you go, well, give me an example of evolution that has been witnessed and documented. Let me give you some of the examples that no doubt some of you have heard. And how they don't hold up, okay? The first is Darwin himself, right? He goes to the Galapagos Islands. He observes the finches. And what did he observe about the finches? The beaks changed, right? They're different sizes for different environments, different climate regions that they lived in and whatnot. Their beaks were different sizes. And so he said, look, they adapted to their environment. They got put into a new place and they changed. And so the bird improved. The bird improved. It's now able to get food better than it did before. And so, see, animals continue to evolve, continue to get better and better and better. Apart from the craziness that we're talking about, the reality that everything that we see came from some single-celled organisms. Is being exampled in millimeters or tenths of a millimeter, right, of a beak size. And we're looking at that little change and going, look, evolution, that means that we came from apes and apes can't. And you're like, okay, we're talking about a little bit of size here. But the reason those beaks changed were simply because of adaptation. And adaptation takes place in animals all of the time. They adapt to their environment. We adapt to our environment, right? People that lived in a cold climate and then they moved to a hot climate, or they moved from a hot climate to a cold climate. Our bodies adjust, and our practices, our eating habits, all that adjust. And the thing that is never noted with Darwin's beaks, because multiple studies have gone back to witness this, is that, so for example, when there was a drought, the birds with the bigger beaks won out because they could actually crack the bigger nuts, and there's a reason why those beaks were bigger. But the thing is when the drought ended, the beaks went back. It changed back again. So what is not usually witnessed or is acknowledged is that this is an adaptation that can ebb and flow. Yes, there might be some progress one way, but then it also goes back. It's not just a continual press forward of progress and progress and progress until you change into a different species. But they look at that one minor change and say, see, look, animals are changing and they're converting into something else. Or maybe you've heard about the fruit flies. The fruit flies in a laboratory, they've tried to breed through genetic manipulation and through breeding fruit flies, because they breed every few days, so it's really easy to observe and watch it happen. They've tried to manipulate and watch these fruit flies mutate over and over again. And they're like, if we can get enough mutations, then we're going to see that throughout all these mutations, there's going to be one that's going to progress and be better, right? Because that's kind of the argument. Yeah, there's a bunch of changes, but in the midst of all that, there was good progress that was made all the way along, and that's why we've got to the species that we have today. Well, the thing is, with all of the manipulation that they've done, yes, they did come up with some new features. Like, they one came out with two sets of wings, so it had four wings instead of two. And they go, look, it improved. It got, you know, double the flying power. The problem is, they're dead wings. They're not connected to any muscles. They're just there. And so in one sense, they don't even help the fly. It's dead weight, right? So these they found that they, and even if they, even with that, they couldn't move it beyond the fact that it's still a fruit fly, right? They didn't morph it into something else. It just became messed up fruit flies. I mean, you keep mutating fruit flies, and you're not going to suddenly, you know, get a mouse or something. It doesn't change species like that. In fact, one of the most famous animal breeders has said that it seems that there might be a natural law that keeps all living things within some more or less fixed limitations. There is kind of a natural law that keeps animals producing after its kind, right? That's what Genesis says, is that the animals produced after its kind and the birds produced after their kind. Or how many of you guys have heard of the peppered moths? Okay, you guys heard of that story, the peppered moths? The story goes that there's these peppered moths. There's a light gray and there's a dark gray, and they would live on trees. And as the Industrial Revolution took off, there was a bunch of smokestacks started getting put up in cities, and it started sending a bunch of soot and smoke into the air, and it then landed on the trees and changed the colors of the trees. And therefore, the light moths stood out on the dark tree, and they got eaten more than the dark moths who blended in to the dark trees that were now covered in soot. Okay? That's the story. And they go, look, this is evolution before our eyes. This is natural selection. See, the nature has a way of showing that the strong survive. And they even have pictures of this, right? I'm sure you guys have seen the pictures of these moths. The problem, they have since found that peppered moths do not perch on trees in the wild. Like, seriously, they live like in the upper canopies of the trees and the leaves and everything, but they don't just park on the trunk of a tree in the wild. It's never been observed. So where did the photographs come from? One scientist who worked with an evolutionary documentary that was trying to prove this case acknowledged later that he had glued dead moths onto the side of trees in order to make this case. I'm not making this up. I mean, that's like, and they're saying, this is science, right? This is unbiased, observable evidence of evolution. And it's a staged thing. Or there's, have you seen the drawing of all the different embryos that all look really similar? By a guy named Ernst, I'm going to mess up his name, Haeckel or Haeckel. So he drew all these embryos of like a cow, a chicken, a pig, and ultimately then a human. And he showed them in like three different stages of development. And and all of his embryos across the board between the animals and the humans all looked extremely similar. Extremely similar. Looks like, and his point is, look, we all kind of came from common ancestry. We all kind of formed the same way. And in fact, he believed that the stages of the embryo from conception all the way through to birth actually replays the whole process of evolution from billions of years ago. And so we're like, each person replays the whole process of evolution as we're forming in our mother's womb. I know, but it's survival of the fittest. The strong survive. The problem is that we now with better imagery and ultrasounds and all the rest, we can actually know better what those embryos look like. And he was way off. He fudged his drawings in order to produce the conclusions that he wanted to produce. There's vast differences in, sure, they all look kind of like a you know, they're all kind of a pre-forming animal, but or human, depending on the embryo you're looking at. But they do look very different. There's differences between them. They don't all look the same. So why do they do these things? Why do they hold these things up? Why are these things still published in your textbooks? And the reason is because the lie needs to continue to go on. They cannot let the lie die. Because as we saw last night, they don't want to believe in anything else. Even if there is no evidence for evolution, they want to continue the story that evolution is how we got here. So, and let me just say, in one sense, I believe in evolution, in microevolution, not macro, okay? The deceptive nature is that they will use the term evolution, capital E, to describe both scenarios. Microevolution refers to what we talked about earlier, the adaptation, the changes within species. Okay, as you breed through, you might get some new characteristics in within dogs, but you're not going to get a different dog. Or you're not going to get a different animal out of that. You might get different variations within the species. I'm happy to call that microevolution. But they say, hey, look, this is evolution. You see these changes? And then they say, so therefore we came from a common ancestry. And you're like, no, wait, you just made a jump right there. We were talking about microevolution, and now you've made a jump to macroevolution, and I'm not willing to make that jump. You see? So we need to define our terms and make sure that we make it clear that what we're talking about here. And they don't, and we don't let them get away with making that jump, where they look at little minor characteristics of changes, and you go, yeah, that's true. There are changes. I'm willing to admit that. But I'm not willing to then say that then there's changes between species. So, the problem with materialism or Darwinism is twofold. One is there's not sufficient evidence for it. I know they pointed to the fossil record. I'm not going to go into the fossil record this morning. But I don't believe that there's sufficient evidence to prove all of the common ancestry. There are still missing links to this day. And in fact, the scientists have basically said, stop looking for the missing links because they're not out there. We're not going to find them. We just got to believe that they morphed between species. We just won't find the proof for it. So there's not evidence for it. And secondly, and this is the point I want to hone in on here this morning, is that it's unlivable. The worldview and perspective of evolution is unlivable. And you're going, what in the world are you talking about? Well, let me... I've entitled this section, Evolution Fails Its Test Drive. Evolution fails its test drive. In other words, if you take evolution out into the real world and live consistent with its presuppositions, it doesn't work. It doesn't work. You see, every worldview must explain our experience in this world. So if you look around, you see this is the way humans interact, this is the way we live, then it's got to be explained by our worldview. But as I'm going to show you, evolution, when it's taken out into the real world of our families and life, they have to live inconsistent with their worldview. They have to, in fact, they openly admit, yeah, this doesn't make sense, I can't explain it with my worldview, but it's there anyway. And so it doesn't pass its test drive. It's like if someone said that they didn't believe in gravity, right? That their worldview was they didn't believe in gravity. Well, you take that out into the real world, and that fails its test drive, right? You take it out and you're like, all right, let's go try no gravity. Nope, still here. Still staying on the ground, gravity is still here. It's not consistent with what you observe in real life. And the same is true with the evolutionary materialistic worldview. It doesn't hold up to life in this world. And we know that because this is God's world and we know how we got here. But let's just look at a couple points here. First is the first way it fails its test drive is in the issue of identity. What are humans? Who are we? Okay. MIT professor Rodney Brooks says that a human being is nothing but a machine, a big bag of skin full of biomolecules interacting by the laws of physics and chemistry. Okay? So we're just a bunch of chemicals and molecules floating around in a bag of skin. A really complex machine. In ordinary life, of course, though, it's difficult to actually see people that way. To look at people and say, you're just a big complex machine. You're like a big complex computer. In fact, he goes, when I look at my children, I can, when I force myself, to see that they are machines. So he's got to really work to apply his worldview when he looks at his kids and say, these little girls and boys are just machines. Okay, yeah, I get, yeah, they're just little machines. But does he treat them that way? Of course not. He says, that is not how I treat them. I interact with them on an entirely different level. They have my unconditional love, the furthest one might be able to get from rational analysis. In other words, he says, my worldview says I need to see them as machines, and yet I treat them with unconditional love, which is the furthest away from scientific rational analysis of what I see. And so he lives with the contradiction. His worldview doesn't allow him to have unconditional love, and yet he has to have it because it fails the test drive. He knows that loving his children and seeing them as something special doesn't fit within his worldview. So he says that he maintains two sets of inconsistent beliefs. He's got the science of the real world in which he convinces himself, no, people are actually just machines. And then he goes over to this part that he can't explain. He doesn't know why he has unconditional love. He doesn't know why he treats his kids differently, but he does anyway. It just doesn't hold true to reality. We know that we are something more special than a machine. Everybody knows that inherently. They want to know that. They want to believe that there's something more than just a bag of molecules, that they're just a complex computer. So evolution fails its test drive with identity, well, who humans are. It also fails its test drive when it comes to freedom, personal freedom, or free will. Philosopher Saul Smilansky says, which I don't expect you guys to know who that is, I'm just telling you this is an actual dude that said this, okay? He says that free will is an illusion. This world is determined by natural forces, by just chemical reactions. Again, everything's got to be explained naturally. But he says that it's a fortunate and necessary illusion because without it, society would break down. Life would be intolerable without it because people would not be responsible for their actions. He basically says free will is an illusion. You don't have free will. You just do whatever nature tells you to do. The molecules bouncing around your head are just like a stream going down a river, and it bounces, you know, it gets shaped by the banks, and it just keeps going where it needs to go. There's no thought, no rhyme to it. It just goes. And the same with you. You just do whatever your all the chemicals and molecules tell you to do. And therefore, you don't have free will. What you do, it can't be explained by personal decisions. It's all deterministic. It's already been determined. But you see, if you have a society that believes that, then the murderer can get up there and say, listen, I don't have free will. I didn't actually choose to do this. This is just because of all the molecules in me. This is what nature led me to do. You see, if you live evolution out, people can't be held responsible for their actions. And so it doesn't hold up. You can't have a society. If you had a society in which people actually lived that way, there'd be anarchy and they'd be killing one another and it would just crumble. And so this naturalistic worldview doesn't fit with reality. It has to bring in an illusion in order to make it fit. Again, they've got their science that sits here, and they say, okay, this is the way I believe things really are. I'm convinced this is it. But then they live over in this realm. They can't explain it, and they just have to call it an illusion. And they live with these two inconsistent, incompatible beliefs. It's contradiction that's in their own, this dissonance that's in their own brains. So we know that the evolutionary view of freedom doesn't hold true to reality. We all make choices freely. Everybody knows that, and we hold people to that. The criminal justice system is built on that fact that people make choices freely, and they should be held accountable for it. So it doesn't hold up to its test drive in the area of freedom. It also doesn't hold up to its test drive in the area of significance. Significance. This is tied into identity, but a little bit nuanced. Because you see, if people are just complex machines or robots, then they have no significance. Everything is determined and there is no free will and you are just doing what you're programmed to do. Therefore, one mom who wrote on the CNN website a few years ago about why she is not teaching her kids about God, she said, because we are just a very, very small part of a big, big machine. and the influence we have is minuscule. We must accept, look at this, the realization of our insignificance. See, she's living out the consequences of a materialistic evolutionary worldview. If we're just machines, a part of one big cosmic natural machine that's chugging forward and improving species, and people are getting and weaker species are getting plowed under, and it's just one big machine, then we're just kind of here for a little bit of time to fight to stay alive for as long as we can, and then we die off and there's no significance. And she's like, we just got to live with that. But you know what? It's that kind of realization, it's that kind of worldview that leaves people to depression, that leaves people to a very hopeless view of life. You have no significance. You're only here to live and die and then go on and be forgotten. And there's no other significance for why you're here. This doesn't fit with reality. We all have a hunger for significance because we're created with a hunger for significance. So lastly, the last piece that in which evolution fails its test drive is in the area of relationships. The area of relationships. Evolutionists tell us that love we feel, again, think of yourselves, you're a complex computer, you're a complex machine. So what is love? Well, love is just chemical reactions going off in your brain. We see something we love, stuff happens in our brains, and we call it love. We're like, oh yeah, that little explosion of chemicals is love. It's as if, you know, it's something that happens in a test tube and we just happen to label it love. So they basically say that true sacrificial love is not possible. Because think about it, if it's survival of the fittest, if it's dog eat dog and you're just trying to get ahead, then why would you care about anybody else? You're only caring for your own survival. You're trying to get rid of the weak. You're trying to stay on top of the food chain. So how can love exist in a worldview that sees survival of the fittest as the story for the world? They say that we only love those who help us in the struggle to survive. So basically, all right, I'm here to survive, and this is kind of like the reality TV shows like Survivor and Amazing Race, right? People are striving for a goal, and if you're going to help me, then okay, I'll let you stay, and I'll like you, right? And they'd say, okay. That's what it is in the real world. We only love those people that are helping us in our struggle to survive. So every act of love is really just selfish. It's just a move to make us, to help our self-interests. And that's what they're saying. They're saying every act of love that we as complex machines make is really just an act of self-love. And so they, one evolutionist called it pseudo-altruism. Which is just another way of saying fake love. We call love, it's actually fake love. It's not true love, as we talk about. But again, this doesn't hold true to reality, guys. We all know that true sacrificial love is indeed a part of the fabric of human nature. In fact, every once in a while, right, you see these videos that float through the internet that's like, watch this video, it'll renew your faith in humanity. Which I don't even know what that means, except for the fact that there's usually some heroic act or somebody who does something really nice for someone when there's no reason to explain it except that they want to help somebody. They want to serve them and want to bring about good in their life. That's a real part of human existence. Sacrificial love is a real part of human existence. So, in all of this, do you see how the Darwinist evolutionary worldview clashes with reality? And you jump in the car of the evolutionary worldview and it runs into a tree. Actually, it doesn't even get going. It just sits there, and they're like, see, we're driving. It's like, no, you're not going anywhere. It's unlivable if you're going to be consistent. And because no one lives it out consistently, they live fragmented lives. They're torn between what they believe and what they experience. And they just don't see this contradiction. Because, as we saw last night, for although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking and their foolish hearts were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools. They sit here, they've rejected God, and now they have this great contradiction in their life and they can't explain it. Well, I believe that Christianity offers a much better, in fact, the best and only solution to these issues of humanity. And it's explained by how God has created us. Christians can live with it as an integrated whole in our lives. We don't have to have fragmented lives. We don't have to believe one thing and then step out into reality and try to take on an illusion of something else. Because what we believe and what God has told us in His Word holds true when we step out and take it for a test drive. And I believe this is how we can make our case for a Christian worldview, is showing that it's livable compared to other worldviews. It aligns with reality. So, as we make a case for a biblical worldview, evolutionists are going to say, you can't bring the Bible into this, right? Because we're talking about science, we're not talking about religion here. But as we saw yesterday, right, evolutionists are religious too. They're just operating off of unbelief, and we're operating off belief. Both of us have a view about God. Both of us have a religious position. One just tries to say that they're not. In fact, one author has said, Darwinism and the view that God created the world are not about different subjects, science versus religion. Instead, they are competing answers to the same question. How did life arise in the universe? They're competing answers to the same question. Both theories appeal to scientific data, while at the same time, both have broader philosophical and religious implications. So we need to be confident what the Bible says, understanding that it is making declarations about reality just like evolution is. And so we need to hold true to the fact that God created the heavens and the earth. So let's flip in our Bibles to Genesis 1. We're not going to do an in-depth study of this passage. I just want us to note a few things as we look at this familiar piece of Scripture. All right, so I'm going to read Genesis chapter 1 just to remind us of the story, remind us of the narrative. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was over the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. And God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. And God saw that the light was good, and God separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness He called night, and there was evening and there was morning the first day. And God said, "Let there be an expanse in the midst of the waters, and let it separate the waters from the waters." And God made the expanse and separated the waters that were under the expanse from the waters that were above the expanse, and it was so. And God called the expanse heaven, and there was evening and there was morning the second day. And God said, "Let the waters under the heavens be gathered together into one place, and let the dry land appear." And it was so. And God called the dry land earth, and the waters that were gathered together He called seas, and God saw that it was good. And God said, "Let the earth sprout vegetation, plants yielding seed, and fruit trees bearing fruit in which is their seed, each according to its kind on the earth." And it was so. The earth brought forth vegetation, plants yielding seed according to their own kinds, and the trees bearing fruit in which is their seed, each according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the third day. And God said, "Let there be lights in the expanse of the heavens to separate the day from the night, and let there be for signs and seasons and for days and years, and let them be lights in the expanse of the heavens to give light upon the earth." And it was so. And God made two great lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night. Oh, and the stars. And God set them in the expanse of the heavens to give light on the earth, to rule over the day and over the night, and to separate the light from the darkness. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening and there was morning the fourth day. And God said, "Let the waters swarm with swarms of living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth across the expanse of the heavens." So God created the great sea creatures and every living creature that moves, with which the waters swarm according to their kinds, and every winged bird according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. And God blessed them, saying, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the waters in the seas. Let the birds multiply on the earth." And there was evening and there was morning the fifth day. And God said, "Let the earth bring forth living creatures according to their kinds, livestock and creeping things and beasts on the earth according to their kinds." And it was so. And God made the beasts of the earth according to their kinds, and the livestock according to their kinds, and everything that creeps on the ground according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness. And let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the heavens, and over the livestock, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. And God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it. And have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moves on the earth. And God said, behold, I have given you every plant yielding seed that is on the face of the earth and every tree with seed in its fruit. You shall have them for food. And to every beast of the earth, and to every bird of the heavens, and to everything that creeps on the earth, everything that has the breath of life, I have given every green plant for food. And it was so, and God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. And there was evening, and there was morning the sixth day. And that is the account of creation. God creating the world. So, let's note just a few points from this passage, okay? The first thing is that God is the source of all things. God is the source of all things. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And he created it out of nothing. It says the earth was without form and void. There was nothing there. It was, as the old theologians say, ex nihilo. It was out of nothing. It's a Latin phrase that means out of nothing. And so this world was created out of nothing by the triune God. He brought about its existence. So nothing receives its existence apart or from any other source. Everything that we see ultimately roots back to God. Thus, his word and his laws give structure to the universe. His word is the source of the laws of physical nature that we study in the natural sciences. And his laws are the source of human nature, the principles of morality, or ethics, of justice, which is politics, of creative enterprise, which is economics, of aesthetics, the arts, and even of clear thinking like logic. That's why Psalm 119:91 says, all things are your servants. You see, guys, there's nothing that does not relate to God. All of life relates to God. We don't ever step into a secular part of life in which God has no opinion about or God has no authority over because he created it all. So the first thing we saw is that God is the source of all things. The second is that all that God created was good. Right? You hear that all through, as we read it. He says, and it was morning, and it was evening, first day, and it was good. Right? He says that it was created good. And so this means that the physical things that God created aren't inherently bad. Okay, there is nothing physical in this world that by itself is sinful. Okay, rocks aren't sinful, trees aren't sinful, plastic isn't sinful, musical instruments aren't sinful. The physical objects, the physical things of this world have been created by God and thus aren't inherently bad. We can't define sin as something as a part of creation. And this is where Christians can often be charged with the accusation of killjoys, right? We say, and some of these examples are from past generations. Maybe you guys aren't hearing them now, but don't watch movies, don't listen to music, don't play cards, don't dance. All these different things. There can be physical things in this creation that we attribute sin to, and we say just avoid those physical things altogether. Rock and roll. That'd be an example. But while we should hate sin, we should also be able to have a deep love for God's handiwork in his creation. We should be able to see through its brokenness and the sin to the original created goodness. We should be known as people in love with the beauties of nature and the wonders of human creativity because we know that it's all expressions of the creative God. God created this world good, as this passage makes very clear. But this passage also clearly feels like it's building up to something, right? It's good, it's good, it's good. And then he reaches the climax. He's getting something super special. And that's the third thing that we see in this passage is that humans were created special. Humans were created special. Notice what God says after he creates man and woman. He says, it was very good. The other days were good, but the day that I created man and woman in my image, it was very good. And so in this, we see the very special nature of man and woman. They were specially created by God. And as the master artist puts down his brush, he stands back with a delighted sigh and says, yes, we just created a masterpiece. That is beautiful. And so this is the first finite creature that's created in the image of the Creator God. This humans will now embody the image and likeness of God. And it's important to note that he wasn't God. He wasn't created a God, Adam and Eve, but they were a representative of God. They were to mirror God to the rest of the world. That's what is meant when it says that God created man in his own image. He created him in the likeness of God. Now, this account, this understanding of where we came from is livable. This creation account works when we step out into reality, which we'd expect because this is God's world. Consider our identity, right? We aren't just complex machines. We are special creatures. We're different from animals. We're not just a more complex animal. We are image bearers of our Creator. This is something that everybody knows, that humans are special, humans are different, and yet people are trying to convince us that we're just no different from the animals, and the animals should have the same rights as humans, and the animals should enjoy the same privileges as humans. It doesn't fly, because we all know there's a fundamental difference. There's an example of chimpanzees that went to court just recently, and they sued in order so that they could have a more livable environment and so they wouldn't be in captivity. And although there wasn't a ruling made yet, the judge said that they have a case and it can go to court. But the irony in all of this, guys, is those chimpanzees would never have done a thing if it wasn't for humans stepping out and actually making the case for them. Right? I mean, if animals are just as similar as humans, then the chimpanzees should be able to stand up for themselves and say, hey, time out. Could I get out of this cage, please? But they can't do that. We have to go help them, which just shows the fact that there's a difference between humans and animals. So when it comes to the issue of identity, we are different and everybody knows it. We're special. When it comes to freedom and free will, it's clear in this passage that as it goes on that God set Adam and Eve in the garden with the ability to choose right from wrong. He created mankind with the ability of free will to choose as they wanted to do. And that makes sense when you and I step out into reality. We jump in that car and we try to drive it and it drives, right? We make choices every day and we're held responsible for those choices. What the Bible says, how we were created, makes sense in everyday life. In the issue of significance, no other understanding of where we came from gives us the significance that the Bible gives us, that we are the special creatures made in God's image. We are the highest value in all of creation. We are special in the eyes of God. And God put us in charge of creation to take care of it. He said, listen, I just created this wonderful world. Who am I going to put there in order to help take care of it, to make sure it's okay? I'm going to put man and woman there. I'm going to put humans there. And so God places a special value upon us with a special responsibility. No other creature was given that responsibility to take care of this planet. And lastly, the issue we looked at of relationship. Relationship. This is livable when it comes to relationship. We're created male and female. Mankind was created in relationship. Why? Because it mirrors a God who is in relationship. The triune God has been in relationship, Father, Son, and Spirit, for all of eternity. There is love at the very core of who God is. Therefore, when he creates, love is baked into his creation. In other words, when we look at our kids, we can explain why we love them. We don't have to say, I don't really know. I just love them, but I know it doesn't make sense. So we can explain where love and relationship come from. It comes from our triune God. And the last piece I want to see, want you to see from this account this morning is the fact that mankind was commissioned. And we're going to look at this more later, but God gave us a task to do. And this is a task that wasn't just given to Adam and Eve, but it's a task that filters down to you and I as well. He said that in verse 28, it says that God blessed them, and then he said, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moves on the earth." So God created man and then set them out on a mission, set them out on a commission. He didn't just give mankind to come and be here and twiddle their thumbs. He says, no, Adam and Eve, I've put you here and I've given you a job to do. Now this commission is composed of two parts. Again, we'll get into this more later. I'm just kind of giving you the overview here. The two parts of this commission is number one, be fruitful and multiply, and number two, subdue the earth. The first part, the be fruitful and multiply, means that man is to develop the social world by building families, churches, schools, cities, governments, and laws, developing societies. But the second part is subdue the earth, have dominion over it. And this means to harness the natural world, plant crops, build bridges, design computers, compose music. And this is what theologians call the cultural mandate. There's a mandate for us to create culture, for us to build families and societies, and for us to take the natural world and form it and create it and build things and use our creativity. God has released mankind to go into the world to make, create, and enjoy. And this has implications on our lives as well, which we'll talk about later. So, just to wrap all this up, Francis Schaeffer, the theologian and philosopher, said that every worldview has to start somewhere, as we've been saying. Either we can start with time plus chance plus an impersonal force, which is what evolution and says, or we can begin with a personal being who thinks, acts, and wills. You got two different choices. And the question before us is, which one is livable? Which one makes sense in this world that we live in? Guys, the Christian worldview tells you that you are specially created in the image of God. You have a high value. You are the crown of His creation. And He called that very good. You have value and significance. You're not a worthless part of this big cosmic machine that's just plowing ahead. You have great value. And this is why, and all people have this value and significance. And this is why Christians should be radically pro-life. Right? That every person, no matter what stage of development, at what level, whatever level of capacity, whether it's in the womb or they're disabled or they're failing health or they're old, we value people because God values people. We value human life because God created mankind special. So as we take this out into the world of competing worldviews, other people who believe different things, the things that you and I have to understand and be committed to deep down in our hearts is the statement that in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Are you convinced that that is truth for everybody? Are you convinced that that is truth for all people over all of time? And if so, then it changes everything. It changes everything. And so we need to be people that stick to the word, not only because God has said it and we believe it, which is true, but also because it's the only worldview that makes sense in reality. Okay? Let's bow in prayer. Our God, we thank you that you have created this world as good as it is. And even though it's broken and fallen, there are still many pieces of your good creation that shine through. And the nature, the trees and everything around us up here is a great reminder of that. But Father, these competing views about where we came from have direct effects upon how humans view themselves and how we see life. I pray, Father, for these students that you would Help them to be able to be firmly convinced in what your word says about where we came from, and that they'd be able to articulate well why they believe it. Pray that you would continue to teach us to do that. It's in Jesus' name we pray. Amen.